Hey there, welcome to the How I Got Hired podcast. I'm your host, Sonal Behel, former HR director and founder of Supercharge. And I have had an insane corporate career that started out in India, then moved to South America, and then to Europe, often working only in Spanish or French, which I had to learn there from scratch. Now, why do I call my career insane? Because while I've experienced complete highs, like working across geographies and industries while navigating challenges like needing visa sponsorships, zero network locally during recessions, and often while being a new mom to one of my two kids, I have seen career heartbreak and multiple layoffs as well. As a career strategist, I strongly believe that a fulfilling career is a birthright and not a privilege for the lucky few who have access to prestigious education, capital, and networks. And now I am on a mission to democratize access to high-value career advice by designing affordable digital courses with my YouTube channel and this podcast right here, where we learn together from ordinary people like you and me and how they created extraordinary career success. I hope this episode reminds you that if they could do it, you can do it too. Now, get ready to get supercharged. Let's go. Hey there, welcome back. Welcome back. My guest today began her career 25 years ago in the Middle East, where she was one of the founding members of McKinsey's offices in the region. And while over there, Dr. Mona Murshid founded and led McKinsey's global education service line, leading research on high-performing and fast-improving school systems, as well as on the challenges of that education to the employment journey, something she was deeply involved with for over 10 years. So in 2014, which is at the time of this recording, pretty much 10 years ago, Mona became founder and CEO of Generation.org. What is that? This is a global nonprofit with a mission to support learners of all ages to be trained and placed in careers that were previously beyond their reach. How does she do that? We're going to talk about that. Mona has a BA from Stanford and PhD from MIT. She holds dual Egyptian and US citizenship. We are going to talk about this career switch and so much more. Mona, such a pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Fantastic, Mona. Let's get cracking right away. I want to talk about the start of your career journey, like I mentioned in the intro, at McKinsey, and you spent the better part of your adult life there. So talk to us about, how did this move happen? How did you get hired there?
So I was very keen to be able to return to the region. The region being the Middle East. And so that was the opportunity which I had as by being part of the McKinsey's Middle East office. And then once I got there, that was a moment in time when many countries in the region were really spending efforts to improve the literacy and numeracy rates within the school systems. And so I very quickly then became very engaged in how can you actually move school system outcomes. And, you know, it's very much like finding your place in the world. As soon as I began working in the education space, it just felt like this is where I should be. This is what was meant to be. And that began my journey in education. And so initially with a focus on K-12, schools, you know, and then at the time, you will recall that it was the moment of the Arab Spring and, you know, around 2010, 2011. And that's when my attention began focusing on youth unemployment, because up until then, I'd been very focused on, okay, if we just improve literacy, numeracy levels, we get students graduated, everything will be fine. But when you have 40% youth unemployment rates, things are not fine. And so that's when I began to focus more upstream, if you will, on what do you do to bridge the education to employment gap.
Perfect, perfect. So I'm just going to pause you here because I want to get more detail here. But when you say, I want to rewind just a second. When you said education, And, you know, you did your BA and you did your PhD. Tell me why the education sector, like what about it appealed to you? Because you probably had so many choices in front of you. I'm talking, you know, 25, 20 years ago. And why this?
Education makes lives, right? Education is what propels you through social adversity. It propels you onto a new economic mobility path. I've seen that happen with my own family. Mm-hmm. And this is the path that I would love to be a part of enabling for others. Right? You know, my father grew up with very little in Cairo. And education was what enabled him to create a life for himself, for my family. Yes. And there is, in my mind, nothing more powerful. You know, so I'm very much a believer, you know, healthcare saves lives. Mm. Education makes lives.
Oh, that is such a tweetable. Healthcare saves lives. Education makes lives. I couldn't agree more. And your dad must be so proud of you, you know, because it's very relatable what you're saying. People from our parents' generation, grandparents' generation, education was such a privilege, you know, to talk about, not something you take for granted. And, you know, when you said, you know, wanted to get back into this region, it's still, right, it wasn't a given. Like, how did, like, McKinsey, like, how did you guys find each other? And do you remember something about the interview process and being given this responsibility? It's not a small thing. Like, is there something that you felt helped you to stand out?
Oh, that's taking me back now many years.
That's the whole idea.
No, I mean, I think, look, whenever you are engaged in starting up any new activity, there has to be a certain amount of passion and hustle and just judgment and problem solving that you bring to it. And that was true in my early days at McKinsey. It's true in Building Generation. You have to want it very deeply to be able to make something happen and to bring something into being that isn't today existing. And then you have to have a great team of people around you who are similarly minded. So those are the things that stand out for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you talked about that, because I talked about this 5 years ago on a 6 years ago on a YouTube video. Hunger. You either want it like really badly or you don't. And recruiters can smell that from a mile away, who's actually window shopping and who really, you know, actually wants this. And it shows in your body language. It shows in everything that you talk about. And do you remember in these years, right, better part of 2 decades that you were here, what are some career highlights, some lessons that have helped shape who you are as a leader today?
Another big question. So I would say there have been a couple of things important in my journey to date. One is to always have a global perspective and not only get stuck in your own myopic view of whatever it is. You know, so I think quite early in my career, I was lucky to be able to, for example, with education systems, to go visit education systems across the world and to understand what is it like to be in a classroom in Singapore or in Finland or in Lithuania or in Brazil, whatever it may be. And so that has always stuck with me, you know, just always understand what it is like to sit in someone else's shoes and do not put your own pattern recognition onto it. See the new pattern that exists.
Yes.
So that's one thing that's been quite formative. Two is just the importance of team. You know, there's that old saying that, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And that's very true. And then you have to find who is your team, right? And who is it that, and the importance as you think about the team of people who think differently than you, because it is that point of friction that is where greatness happens in terms of taking leaps and bounds. You know, so never surround yourself with people who only think like you. Deliberately surround yourself with people who think differently than you, so that you are a complementary whole that can go much further together.
Exactly.
And I think the last thing, you know, you always need new challenge. Like, never get comfortable. As soon as you get comfortable, you get timid. Right. So always push to what is the next thing? What is the next thing in order to grow? Right. And that, you know, I've been very blessed that, you know, every year there's something different in my world that enables me to take the skills that I've gained and to apply them in a really different way and to learn new things. And then the final thing that I'll say is, you know, learning comes from everywhere. Right. So I learn as much from those who are early in their career as those who are more senior in their career. So just always be open to learning from everyone in your orbit. Do not only think that learning happens from those who are more senior to you.
Yes, exactly. I think each of these are, you know, they're so rich. They deserve, honestly, I think I need to double click. The echo chamber effect is very real. We see this in today's world. It's a massive problem with senior leaders because they surround themselves with yes men and people who agree. And they don't see obstacles because nobody talks about them, right? And pattern recognition, what is normal, right? And I think what you're saying goes deeper. Like, the day-to-day, she has an accent. She has an accent compared to what? Because pattern recognition, what you're saying is we center ourselves as the norm and then everything else. And then look at it from a completely different angle. And I think what you said is really, really important. So if I'm talking to the listener right now, you were like, oh, this is cool. No, hold on. Rewind 120 seconds and listen to that part again, because it was really relevant. Comfort is the enemy of growth. When you get comfortable, you get timid. You're right. We have lots of fear and we come from uncomfortable. Ego loves that. Don't get me out there. It's too scary. I'm so warm and cozy in my blanket right now. I don't want to go out there in the cold or, you know, in unknown circumstances. And lastly, learning, if you have, you know, less or no ego, you can learn from your mentees. You learn from students. You learn from children. You learn from sources that you don't think are traditional sources of wisdom.
Absolutely.
So that's beautiful. Beautiful.
I also learn from my daughter every day.
I learn
from her literally something every day.
Every single day. I love that. So everything was going really well. Mona, talk to us about, like, some might say you left that, you know, speaking of comfort is the enemy of growth. Maybe that's where we're going right now. You left that comfort of, and I put comfort in air quotes, employed life at McKinsey. So you 10 years ago and you go ahead and you start generation.org. Tell us about what were you thinking and also what followed next? What were those early months, early years? What were they like? And we also want to learn from you the mission. Like, how do you get people placed into roles that are considered beyond their reach? We want to know lots of stuff.
Absolutely. So I had mentioned earlier that around 2011 was the time of the Arab Spring. And on the heels of the Arab Spring was the global Occupy movement. So if you will remember Occupy Wall Street, and then it became Occupy movements across cities in the world. And that was when I began realizing, you know, this bridge from education to employment. So what happens post-secondary school education was an area where I wanted to spend time. And so that was the spark, that was the trigger for my shift, at least from K-12 to looking at post-secondary. And that then led to an exploration around what does it take to be able to train in place tens of thousands of people into new careers. And as I was looking across the world, you know, so there are lots of programs that train you, and they can be very large programs, but they can have a very low job placement rate, you know, so like 15-20%. And then there are programs that train and place you in a job, but they tend to be much lower volume. So it tends to be, you know, in the hundreds, low thousands on an annual basis, but they have a job placement rate of 70% or above. And so for me, the question was, okay, well, could there be something in the middle? You know, can something train and place you, have tens of thousands of people who go through it every year and have an 80% plus job placement rate, and be cost effective and be global? And so that's really what led to the thinking behind Generation. So we are a global nonprofit, and we started life in 2015. And what we do is train and place adults into careers that would otherwise be inaccessible. And so we began initially with a focus on youth. Then we expanded to adults of all ages, because mid-careers and those seeking to transition to new careers, it comes across the entire age spectrum. And we now have 100,000 graduates. Half of them have been in the last 2 years, so we're now growing quite quickly. We measure our impact in terms of what we call breadth, depth, and durability. And for us, I want to really emphasize, like, scale equals breadth plus depth plus durability. Scale, I think, is often confused as being breadth alone. That is not good enough, right? Mm. So breadth is the volume of our employers and our graduates on an annual basis. Depth is our employment and income outcomes at 3 to 6 months, which, you know, so now we have about an 80% job placement rate at 3 months. It becomes about 90% at 6 months post-program. And then the durability is the employment, income, and well-being outcomes up to 5 years post-program. So we continue tracking to see, has this actually resulted in a shift in the lives of our alumni? So our graduates have now earned over $1 billion in wages. And we know that that within a year, in about 11 of our countries, over 70% of our graduates achieve living wage. And that continues 2 to 5 years out for our employed graduates. We know what happens in terms of savings. We know what happens in terms of well-being. You know, we have now about 40 million data points across the spectrum. So, and we work across now about 35 professions, and they span tech, healthcare, customer service, skilled trades, and green jobs. And so we are still on the learning journey, but we feel like there is a code that we are beginning to crack about not just how you get someone in a job, but you get them to life transforming outcomes over the 5 years post that initial job placement.
Wow. I'm blown away. 100,000 graduates. And I've seen the website as well. So many countries. And even though every, you know, country has a different language, the look and feel is very similar. And I like, it's repeatable. You know, you don't waste time. The very first page you talk about, you know, the mission. And I love this definition of scale. And I'm going to use this with your permission again and again.
You're because welcome.
Scale, yeah, thank you. Scale is seen in such a myopic way as breadth. And if you don't have breadth, you don't have scale. Breadth, depth, and durability. Durability is obviously the one that is most overlooked, because we are almost always short-term driven, short-term focus. But looking at the quality of life, looking at everything that you said, life transformation. And I love that you said living wage and not minimum wage, because minimum has never been good enough, not for a half decent life, right? So, wow. To think, Mona, this came from an idea, right? And look at how, I know you're so humble, and you're like, we're still learning. We're figuring a few things out. We're learning, but we have a little formula in place. We are still early in the journey. What does it take? I wasn't planning to ask you this, but, you know, people start companies every day. People start things with an idea, and there's so much data out there. It doesn't survive. 2 years, 3 years, they shut shop, wasn't scalable, whatever definition of scale they were using. And here you are on the heels of your, you know, celebrating the 10th anniversary. What does it take to last?
So many things. So I think, first of all, we've been blessed to have tremendous supporters in our journey. And, you know, so from funders to governments to our learners, we learn from them every day.
Teams, right? I saw a very diverse team
across the world, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we are blessed with our team. And team involving, you know, also our broader ecosystem, if you will. I think the second thing I'd say is, and this is another saying, fall in love with the problem, not with your solution. Right? Because life changes. You know, COVID mm-hmm. happened. That changed mm-hmm. the way of work in many ways. And then the last thing I'd say is, you know, the more we have grown, the more we realize we have yet to do, right? You know, I think that the aspirations we started with in 2015, if you were to ask me now, well, how have you, our aspirations have grown as we have matured. And so that means that we're actually much more distant from where we want to ultimately be, you know? So if you know, so there was, when I was in the Middle East, there was once an interview with a journalist and one of the leaders in the region. And they asked him, like, you know, how much of your aspirations for the country have you achieved? And, you know, this was in the early 2000s. And he said, you know, like, whatever, 20%. And then that same journalist came back several years later and asked that same question. And he said, it's 5%. Because the dreams had become so much bigger, right? And I feel that that is the same for us now that we've seen where the needs are. You know, so for example, you know, we were initially and continue to be very focused on in-country delivery to train and place people in their country. But now we're thinking about, well, what about job deserts across the world? How could we support individuals who live in job deserts anywhere in the world?
What's a job desert, Mona?
It's a place where you live where there is very minimal job availability.
Right? Is it because of low population pockets?
Just low business presence, right? Be able to create
job desert.
Also think of refugee populations. There's just not enough jobs, right?
Even though they're very skilled, oftentimes.
So I
completely understand.
You know, so job deserts was not something that we were thinking about in 2015, and today we are, right? And so that's what I think about. The more that you do, the more you realize you can and should do in to be in service of the mission.
Love that. Fall in love with the problem, not with the solution. It's a great, great point, particularly when someone is listening and they're like, I'm preparing a presentation, I'm preparing a pitch. We do want to fall in love with our solution. It feels so good. But that detachment needs to be practiced, that you're only looking at it from the point of view of the problem. And I don't know who said this philosopher, I don't know, is it Aristotle? The more I learn, the less I know.
Yes, right? That's pretty much
That's what you just said. You know, and I also think you're probably being very modest here, you know, Mona, when you say you're very blessed. You know, you choose the team around you, right? And you've chosen good players, top players. And someone who's listening today who would like to get into the nonprofit world, maybe they're changing careers and they're like, I'd love to be a nonprofit. I'm very mission driven. And you, I guess, do so many interviews. You do lots of hiring, particularly at, you know, the senior levels. What are some traits you see yourself looking for again and again, that you know that it would be a good fit, it would be a good add to the generation.org culture?
So probably a couple of things. I mean, one, someone who has a builder mindset. You know, so if you think of builders and managers, so the world needs both. And certainly within an organization, you need both. But when you are in the stage of going from 0 to 10, or even 10 to 100, you very much need a group of builders who can take a concept or take a set of tools and turn it into something real on the ground in whatever capacity that means. So builder is one part of it. Two is being very able and comfortable to navigate ambiguity. You know, the world is changing rapidly on so many different fronts, whether it's the labor markets or geopolitically or whatever it is. Right? And so you have to be able to roll with the punches. And so that is a really important attribute. And then obviously we need people with deep expertise in a particular area, but much more importantly is the ability to be cross-functional, you know, to understand, to not be so deep in your area that you can't build bridges with all of the other functions or with other regions, because ultimately it's at that intersectionality that you see the most opportunity. Yes. So those are just a couple of things.
Yeah. No, those are very useful. Builder, you do need builders and managers, but someone who's comfortable building, you know, because also in not-for-profit, that entrepreneurial mindset, you got to do more with less. There's a word in Hindi. I love this word. It was used by a very famous lady. Her name is Leila. She passed away at 37 years old. She passed away from cancer in the US. And she did a lot of work on poverty alleviation. And she defined jugaad. The Hindi word jugaad literally means do more with less. Mm. So my Hindi speaking listeners are going to be like, oh yeah, we know. There's always a solution, you know, and do it in a way, obviously in a legal sort of way. But that mindset of an ambiguity and being comfortable with ambiguity and not, you know, having anxiety about, but I don't know what this means for us. Like, yeah, we'll figure it out, you know, step by step. Love that. And lastly, the wearing, sometimes we have to wear many hats. You know, doing one thing isn't good enough because we want to do more. We want to do more with less resources because resources are not thrown around like they are in the private sector. I understand that. So that was very useful. Thank you. I have this juicy question for you coming up, Mona. We talked about education and the importance of it, and I love that you took your own so very seriously with studying, you know, studies at Stanford and MIT, which are prestigious institutions, not very easy to get in. So I'm guessing lots of hustle, burning midnight oil and you know, taking yourself seriously and making the commitment to make that happen. And now here we are in the 2020s, where we see this sort of, I don't know if you see this, but I see this growing movement, a little bit like anti-education, especially amongst the youth on social media. And some of it I understand, you know, about high expenses, educational debt, particularly in countries like the US, where higher education is exorbitantly priced. And some even go so far as to say, and LinkedIn has come out and said this, who's doing more skill-based hiring versus, you know, skill and talent-based hiring versus education and diploma and all of that stuff. I want to know your thoughts on all this. And in 2024 and beyond, Mona, what do you see is, you know, the changing role of education?
So there's so many thoughts sparked by those questions. Let me just start by saying education has always been important. It will continue to be important because learning is how we grow. Learning is how we get new skills. This debate right now in my mind is about what kind of education is worth it. So it is not about education, yes or no. It's about what is the kind of education that will propel a child, an adult forwards. And that's a very important distinction. When you look at the research, what I will also say is that, you know, there have been all types of research that try to understand, are there certain degrees, so academic degrees or academic majors, that have a greater ROI in terms of income relative to others. And those, you know, historically have said, well, if you go into STEM disciplines, you have a higher ROI than if you do a liberal arts degree. But I'll tell you, you know, I saw research just the other day about cognitive flexibility, you know, so those who have a double major, who go into, you know, let's say chemistry and literature, right, you know, where you have a double major in different disciplines, they actually have the highest ROI of all, because of the nature of that work, they are very deliberately in interdisciplinary types of roles, which is much harder to automate or digitize as you think moving forwards. So this is just a long way of saying there is an important reckoning about what is the type of education that is most useful and which most accelerates learning. There are movements now around how do we do more bite-sized learning. So instead of you doing like, you know, let's say a master's for a year or an undergraduate degree for this period of time, is it more useful to sort of have like learning on demand, if you will, right? You know, so this is a specific skill. Here's the learning for it, et cetera. There is that. There is the skills-based hiring movement that you just mentioned, but I will also, and that's learning that employers need to do, but I will also say there, there is both from our own research and recent research put out by others, there is a lot more talk about skills-based hiring and not as many companies actually hiring in that way. Actually, there are many companies that, one, don't believe that a shift to skills-based hiring is the best path for them. And second, companies that say that they are doing it, but they are hiring the way they traditionally hired, and it is those who have college degrees. So there's still a lot to be worked out on how do you get employers to shift. But what I would lastly say is, you know, with everything that has been happening post-COVID with AI, there has never been a higher premium on how do you learn quickly than there is today. Because job tasks keep changing, because new professions are emerging. And so figuring out and proactively investing in yourself so that you learn how to use whichever AI tool is the one that you prefer. I mean, it's just, you've got to invest proactively in yourself learning that, even if you are teaching yourself through available online material or content. Don't just wait for an employer to train you. That will come, but employers are still also figuring that out themselves. And in the meantime, you can materially make yourself more valuable in your role by learning these things yourself. So those are a lot of different thoughts, Sonal. Most organized way, but that's what your question sparked for me.
No, that's very useful. My question wasn't the most organized to begin with. So your answer was very useful. And I love the last part of your answer because learning has never been more accessible, more affordable, and more portable, literally in a couple of inches in our pocket than it is today. So there's no excuse and no need to wait for, and we have to be proactive and not wait for someone to do this for us. And I'm so glad you made that distinction between formal learning, formal education versus informally doing it with or without, you know, the cape and the sash and that tassels, you know, that graduation cap, which I guess if we Google education, if you Google that as an image, that is what comes up, you know, formal degree and somebody, a dean is speaking. But there's so many different ways of learning. The other thing that you said was the say-do gap. Oh, what they say versus what they do. That's important to highlight because a lot of companies, private, public, not-profit, whatever they are, a lot of them are giant behemoths. And things can move at a glacial pace. So in spite of, negating myself, but in spite of all the trends we see, it is still like, you know, at the surface, but deeper, people take a while to change. Habits are, old habits die hard, right? So people say they're doing skills-based hiring, but when you interview people in your research, oh, yeah, you have a four-year degree, we want to hire you. A lot of hiring came from that source. So I'm so glad you talked about that. All right, fantastic. So Mona, go ahead.
I'll just add one piece of research which we did. So we were looking at how to support underrepresented communities to enter tech roles across the world. And so we surveyed thousands of employers and job seekers in tech roles, existing employees, across 8 countries. What we found is that even though employers, something like 60% plus of them, said that hiring for entry-level roles needs to be completely overhauled and that they struggle to find the talent they need, over the last 3 years, the vast majority of employers actually raised education requirements and work experience requirements. And so this is
why?
Well, and this is now happening at the time of the skills-based hiring dialogue also really surging. And so what we found is, you know, for some employers, they'll say, look, you know, we don't have enough managers to be able to sufficiently train and support entry-level hires who don't have those degrees or don't have the 2 years of work experience, right? And so actually, like for 94% of companies, the entry-level role, as we understand it, has gone. You know, so the entry-level role being like, this is your first experience in the role.
Yeah.
So the entry-level job is just gone. Right? And that's a really important realization. So I just share that to say that it's very entrenched and requires a lot of deep exploration of why are employers making these choices, because they make choices for a reason. And we need to understand them deeply in order to figure out, is there a different path here?
Yeah. And they make choices for a reason. They make decisions for a reason. And we have to follow the money, because that reason comes from a lot of times, because time is limited, resources are limited. And ultimately, it's about the bottom line. I love that. But I don't love that. I like that you gave this nuanced, approach. But the entry level role, hey, my first job in my life, hey, welcome. If that has gone, right? And they keep saying 2 to 5 years, that's not fair, because that's setting that 21, 22-year-old up for failure, because they're like...
It also means it's really important to do the internships and the apprenticeship, you know, so all of these things that give you exposure while you are still a student become all the more important.
Yes, exactly. I totally understand. All right, Mona, so we've come close to the end, and I want to ask you, when you look back on your career, these 25 years or so, is there one standout defining moment that supercharged your career and helped you to move closer to your current success?
Really hitting me with the big questions here. So
it's kind of my thing.
I think the Arab Spring Occupy movement period was just really formative in where should I spend the next part of, or the next chapter of my career. I'll put it that way. You know, sometimes there are defining moments in time because of where you are, because of who you are, that really brings clarity as to where is the most value-adding place you can be. And so that very much set me on the generation path. So I will pick that one as my most defining moment.
Profound. Yeah, absolutely. Totally understand that. All right, fantastic. Dr. Mona Murshed, how can people learn more about you and follow your work?
So our website is generation.org. So please do visit. For anyone who would like to get in touch, we also, on the website, there are many ways, just through the contact us. to be in touch if you either want to explore our programming or want to continue this dialogue. And Sonal, thank you so much for hosting me today.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much and for your time today. And we wish you the best with generation.org and beyond.
Hey there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to today's show. If you loved it, please do leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. I search high and low to bring you the very best guests, and I'm so proud to bring you their stories and game-changing career lessons. The best compliment that you could ever give me is taking a screenshot of today's episode and sharing it with your LinkedIn network and tagging me at Sonal Behal, S-O-N-A-L-B-A-H-L. All right, I look forward to spending time together on the next episode of the How I Got Hired podcast. Take care of yourself and bye for now.